Blog Talk Radio.
Little children in this beloved America are forced to grow up.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators, but we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. And we will be able to rise from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. And this will be a great America. We will be the participants in making it so. And so as I leave you this evening, I say, walk together, children. Don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the corner.
In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rotten pits of burning field slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions. They find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. In a sense, the greatest tragedy of this other America is what it does to little children. Little children in this other America as we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-Americans, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians, Some happen to be from other groups. Millions of them are Appalachian whites. Probably the largest group in this urban America in proportion to its size in the population is the American Negro. American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto. A ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto is to deal with this problem.
To deal with this problem of the true America.
We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Hallelujah, say that
the struggle for civil rights, the struggle to make these two Americas one America,
is no more difficult today than it was 10 years ago. For about a decade, or maybe 12 years, we struggled all across the South in glorious struggle to get rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounded that system of segregation. And then this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodation. Public transportation was segregated. Often we had to sit at the back, and within transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. The struggle was to deal with these problems. Certainly, they were difficult problems, and they were conditions. By the thousands we protested these conditions, we made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousands, students and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. When they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream, seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being. After the Birmingham movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation, to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma movement in 1965, we were able to get a voting rights bill. Now, all of these things represented strides.
But we must see that the struggle of today is much more difficult.
It's more difficult today because we are working now
for equality.
It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good quality of job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park
than it is to make a community integrated education.
And so today we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. Not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. I'm convinced that many of our people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I think that the change in power that we have lived with, some of the people who came quickly in my mind with themselves and Birmingham, were active around Chicago. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. So as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked, that Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. The unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than white. As we look at these problems, we will be growing and developing every day. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate of the nation as a whole is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. These are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs until they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope. They've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor for them with no exit sign. So they no longer go to look for a job. There are those who would estimate that these persons who are all various persons, these 6 or 7% in the Negro community, that means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 60%. Among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. So you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many of us didn't see well during the last 10 years, that is racism. It's still alive in American society, much more widespread than we realize. And we must see racism for what it is. It's the myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is the false and tragic notion that one particular group, one particular race is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insight, and the total flow of history, and the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved. And the final analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick and tragic man who carried racism to its logical conclusion. He ended up leading a nation to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. And this is the tragedy of racism because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I'm not good enough to live next door to him, one says that I'm not good enough to get up and run from him, that I have a good reason to go out and go to school with him, merely because of my race. He is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. To use a philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are behind culturally or otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very being of people is inferior. This is the great tragedy of it.
At that same period,
America was giving millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest. This is why Frederick Douglass could say that emancipation for the Negro was freedom to hunger, freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. He went on to say that it was freedom without bread to eat, freedom without land to cultivate. It was freedom and famine of clean water. But it does not stop there. In 1875, the nation passed the Civil Rights Bill and refused to enforce it. 1964, the nation passed a weaker Civil Rights Bill. And even to this day, that bill has not been enforced in all institutions and amendments. The nation heralded a new day of concern for the poor, for the poverty-stricken, for the disadvantaged, and brought into being a poverty bill. But at the same time, put such little money into the program that it was hardly and still remains hardly a good skirmish against poverty. White politicians and suburbs talk eloquently. And in the same breath pretend that they are not racist. All of this, all of these things tell us that America has been backlashing on the whole question of basic constitutional and God-given rights for Negro for more than 300 years. So these conditions, the symptoms of widespread poverty, of slums, and of tragic conditions in schools and of areas of life, all of these things have brought about a great deal of despair, a great deal of desperation, a great deal of disappointment and even bitterness in the Negro community. Today, all of our cities confront huge problems. All of our cities are potentially powder kegs as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger, many in moments of deep bitterness, engaged in riots. Let me say, as I've always said, and I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve. That in a real sense it is impractical for the Negro to even think of mounting a violent revolution in the United States. So I will continue to condemn riots, continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way. Continue to affirm that there is another way. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the condition which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. I think America must see certain conditions continue to exist in our society. In the final analogy, a riot is the language of the unheard. This is an America that failed to hear. of that large segment of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about equality and humanity. A cause for our nation's winters of delay, as long as America holds justice, we stand at the liberty of having these recordings of our riots over again. There is evidence and progress on the active guarantors of riot prevention. Now let me go on to say that if we are beyond all of the problems that I've talked about, if we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America in order to deal with the problems that I have mentioned. Now, in order to develop these massive action programs, we've got to get rid of one or two false notions that continue to exist in our society. One is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. I'm sure you've heard this idea. It is the notion almost that it's something in the very flow of time that will miraculously cure all evil. And I've heard this over and over again. There are those, and they're often sincere people, who say to Negroes and their allies in the white community that we should slow up and just be nice and patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years the problem will work itself out, because only time can solve the problem. Well, I think that is an answer to that myth. And it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. I am absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous in our nation, have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. It may very well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words of the bad people and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people. Sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the inability to focus. So we must help time. We must realize that the time is always right to do right. Now, that's another notion that gets out. It's around everywhere. It's in the South. It's in the North. It's in California and all over our nation. It's the notion that legislation can't solve the problem. It can't do anything in this area. And those who project this argument contend that you've got to change the heart, and that you can't change the heart through legislation. My position on this is that it is really a lot of change in our country, and I believe in changing the heart. We speak about it. I believe in the need for conversion, and in incentives and regeneration, if you feel up to the time. And I think it's the white person must treat the Negro right. Not merely because of the law that I've been in the government, because it's right. The Negro is the law. I realize that we have to have a truly integrated society. Men and women have to provide the justification of another thing which is the other side. Even though it may be true that the law cannot change the heart, it can restrain the heart.
Problem.
everything that I see with what you all are doing is that every time I see you and other Negroes, you are protesting. You aren't doing anything for yourself.
Them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here.
the men the world over. Deep rumblings have been here today. Rumbling of discontent is a thunder of disinherited matter. Rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. All over the world, like my freedom for freedom is spreading in the widest liberation movement in history. Great man asks the people are determined to end the exploitation of our races and lands. In one majestic chorus, they're singing the words of our freedom song, and they let nobody turn us around. So for the vision, of course, is that the people cry for freedom, and the Congress which attempt to legislate oppression. Millions, yes, millions are appropriated for mass murder. The most meager pittance of foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment raises at a major depression level in the black ghettos. But bipartisan response is an anti-riot deal rather than a serious poverty program. The money goes to our model cities, rent supplement, and rat control, pitiful as it were to begin with, yet caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-liberal than anti-rat needs to be dismissed.
Control. And
United Patriots Network. This is mine for a political and independent approach to the needs of our brothers. Our homeland meeting stopped as of September 15th, and a very meaningful program is discontinued. Yes, the hour is dark. Evil comes forth in the guise of good. It is a time of much difficulty. Many places there be high blood pressure of persistent rhetoric and an anemia of concrete performance. We crowd out against welfare and our handouts to the poor, but generally approve an oil depletion allowance to make the rich richer. Six Mississippi plantations receiving more than $1 million a year, not plant poppy, but no decision is made to feed the tenant farmer who is put out of work by the government subsidy. While our achievements in hypocrisy, Republicans and Democrats of the Midwest and West, who get given land by our government when they came here as immigrants from Europe. They were given education through the land grant colleges. They were provided with agricultural agents to keep them abreast of farming trends. They were granted low interest loans to aid in the mechanization of their farms. And now that they have succeeded in becoming successful, they are paid not for farms. These are the same people who now say to black people whose ancestors were brought to this country in chains, who were emancipated in 1863 without being given land to cultivate and bread to eat, that they must pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. What they truly advocate is socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I would like to say that this is just a passing phase in the cycle of our nation's life. Many times of war times of reaction throughout the society. But I suspect that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness that has been lurking within our body politic from its very beginning. That is, this is the racism, excessive materialism and militarism. Not only is this our nation's dilemma, it is a plague of Western civilization. Early 1906, W.B. Du Bois prophesied that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. Now as we stand two-thirds in this crucial period of history, we know no well that racism is still that hound of hell which dogs the tracks of our civilization. Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality
Remember in favor of ignorance and stupid.
attention. But all the lag must be redeemed. When scientific power outruns moral power,